Imagine a local city council meeting in like rural America accidentally bottlenecking the global AI race,
Right.
or a regional drought in one hemisphere causing maritime insurance rates to just explode on the other side of the planet.
Yeah, it's wild.
Because when we normally look at the daily news, we tend to treat it like a scoreboard, you know?
Yeah.
What happened today? Who won? Who lost? What is the latest immediate crisis?
Yeah, it is a highly transactional way to view the world.
Exactly.
We're constantly reacting to the immediate score without ever really looking at the architecture of the field itself or, you know, asking why the rules of the game seem to be changing in real time.
Well, today we are stepping entirely off that playing field. So, welcome, Truth Seekers, on behalf of the Great Awakening Report to this week's Truth Seekers Weekly Briefing Mainstream Media Review for July 17th.
Glad to be here for it.
Today, our mission in this deep dive is to completely change how you consume information. We are going to sift through the July 17th briefing source material and learn how to move past the deafening noise of the daily headlines.
Right, because there's so much noise right now.
So much. Our goal is to spot the underlying signals, follow those threads, and really uncover the larger structural patterns of what the briefing calls the great global convergence.
And, you know, that concept of a convergence, it's really the master key for understanding this moment in time.
Yeah.
Looking at the Truth Seekers weekly briefing document, it is deeply focused on systems awareness. We aren't just analyzing isolated geopolitical events anymore.
Right, they aren't isolated at all.
Exactly. We are observing how seemingly separate global happenings like technology, supply chains, climate, institutional trust, how they're actually profoundly intertwined.
Yes.
And what is crucial here for you listening is that we approach this with a very calm, observational tone.
Right, no panic.
Exactly. This entire exercise is about discernment. We want to recognize these massive overlapping shifts without succumbing to fear or reactivity. We are essentially stepping into the role of the grounded, rational observer.
I love that. But before we jump into the deep end, I do need to give a crucial disclaimer for you listening. Our sources today cover some highly politically charged material.
They definitely do.
Yeah, specifically regarding former President Trump, the 2020 election, and China. So we want to be crystal clear right out of the gate here. We are not taking any political sides here, nor are we endorsing the viewpoints or claims of the original content.
Right, that's not what this deep dive is about.
Exactly. Our job is simply to impartially report on the ideas contained in the source material and see what underlying patterns it reveals. So, okay, let's unpack this.
Let's do it. I think we should start with the very first major headline in the briefing.
The one about the information battleground.
Yeah, exactly. The new strategic battleground of information. It highlights Donald Trump's primetime national address regarding newly declassified intelligence on alleged Chinese interference in the 2020 election.
Right, and the briefing gets pretty detailed on this.
It is highly specific. It mentions the acquisition of massive U.S. voter data sets, advanced cyber capabilities, and, you know, the deployment of broader influence operations.
And it also notes China's subsequent very public denial of those allegations.
Yes, it does.
But let me stop you there because I want to push back on the mechanics of this for a second.
Okay, go for it.
Stealing a data set is one thing. A cyber breach makes sense to me in a like a traditional espionage way.
Sure.
But how does acquiring an Excel sheet of voter registrations actually translate into a quote broader influence operation?
That's a great question.
I mean, what does that mechanism actually look like on a Tuesday night when a regular citizen is just scrolling their phone?
Well, that is the pivotal question because it moves us from simple data theft to psychological warfare.
Okay, here.
When a state actor acquires large voter data sets, they aren't just looking at names and addresses.
Right, they're not just mailing you a pamphlet.
Exactly. They cross-reference that data with consumer habits, social media profiles, and geolocation histories. Yeah. They use advanced algorithms to build incredibly accurate psychological profiles of specific voting blocks.
So it's hyper-targeted.
Hyper-targeted. So when that citizen is scrolling on a Tuesday night, they aren't seeing a blatant foreign propaganda poster.
Right.
They are seeing a highly targeted, organically generated meme, or maybe a local news story taken completely out of context that is specifically designed to trigger their pre-existing anxieties.
That is terrifying.
And here's the thing, the goal isn't necessarily to change their vote.
Wait, really? Then what is it?
Often the goal is simply to make them so deeply cynical that they stop trusting the electoral process entirely.
Huh. You know, I was thinking about this, and it really feels like modern national security is functioning like a biological immune system.
Oh, that's an interesting way to put it.
Yeah, like our physical borders, our military, they are the skin.
Right.
But this kind of information warfare is a virus bypassing the skin entirely to attack the immune system itself.
Which is public trust.
Exactly, public trust. Because if you can make a population doubt their own institutions, you don't need to breach their physical borders. The host body attacks itself.
Yeah, the reaction from the mainstream media to this primetime address perfectly illustrates your immune system analogy, honestly.
How so?
Well, if you look at the systemic response, the focus in the newsrooms wasn't primarily on the intelligence claims themselves.
Right, they barely talked about the actual data.
Exactly. Instead, the narrative instantly shifted to the editorial decisions of the networks.
Oh, right, like whether they should even be showing it.
Yes, it became a frantic debate over whether to broadcast the speech live, interrupting it with a real-time fact-checking, and really framing the entire event around the concepts of misinformation and the protection of democratic norms.
So the debate wasn't about the data at all, it was about the gatekeeping of the data.
Exactly. The pattern emerging here is that information itself has become the new strategic domain of global competition. We used to think of warfare and national security purely in terms of land, sea, air, and space. Now, the primary target is the cognitive infrastructure of a nation.
Cognitive infrastructure, that's a powerful phrase.
And that intense media debate over broadcasting and fact-checking, that is the immune system responding, sometimes overreacting, but trying to figure out how to process an anomaly in real time.
So what's the ultimate takeaway from that section of the briefing?
That securing physical voting machines is no longer enough. The entire information ecosystem is now recognized as critical national infrastructure.
And it's wild because this panic over securing invisible digital infrastructure is actually crashing headfirst into a massive panic over securing physical goods.
Absolutely.
Just as nations are fiercely guarding their data, they are suddenly having to violently protect their physical supply lines.
It's a huge shift.
Yeah, the briefing moves right into the ongoing Middle East crisis next, specifically U.S. and Iran tensions and the mounting pressure points in Lebanon. And it highlights a staggering detail that I couldn't believe. One-fifth of the entire world's seaborne oil supply passes through the Strait of Hormuz.
The massive bottleneck.
20% of global energy bottlenecked in one geographic location.
But we have to ask ourselves why this matters today in a way it didn't say a decade ago.
See, that is exactly what I am struggling with, because here's where it gets really interesting, but also genuinely confusing for me.
Yeah.
Isn't the Middle East always tense? I mean, historically, this area has been a geopolitical flashpoint for decades.
Sure it has.
So what makes this a new pattern that we need to pay attention to rather than just the historical status quo?
What makes this a new pattern is the velocity and the sheer scale of the global consequence.
Okay, unpack that.
Because of how tightly wound and hyper-optimized the global economy has become over the last 20 years, a regional conflict is no longer contained to that region.
It spills over immediately.
It is a live fire test of global strategic resilience. Let's look at the actual mechanism of how this works. The moment a threat is perceived near the Strait of Hormuz, maritime insurance agencies, institutions like Lloyd's of London, they immediately reclassify the zone as high risk.
So the ships can still physically pass through, but the paperwork changes?
And that paperwork is incredibly expensive.
Oh, I bet.
Ships suddenly have to pay what are called war risk premiums. In a matter of hours, the insurance on a single massive oil tanker can jump from 0.05% of the ship's total value to over 1%.
Wait, really? 1% of a whole tanker?
Yeah, on a $100 million vessel, that is an extra $1 million just to cross a narrow strait.
Just to pass through.
Exactly. And that cost doesn't just evaporate. It is immediately passed down the supply chain, which drives up the cost of shipping, which fuels global inflation, and instantly destabilizes energy markets worldwide.
It is the butterfly effect, but like weaponized by global finance.
Very much so.
And that ties directly into the briefing's larger insight on global supply chains, because for the last 30 years, the global economic model was built on this just-in-time globalization.
Right. Maximum efficiency.
Yeah, the entire goal was efficiency. Don't store inventory in a warehouse because warehouses cost money.
Exactly.
Just have the parts arrive on a truck the exact morning you need them on the assembly line.
Which works brilliantly on a spreadsheet
Yeah.
in a perfectly peaceful world.
Right.
But the moment a single shipping lane gets blocked or, you know, a pandemic hits, suddenly a car manufacturer in Michigan has to halt production of a $60,000 vehicle.
Because they're missing one tiny part.
Because a 10-cent microchip is stuck on a boat halfway around the world, the old model of maximum efficiency is officially dead.
And the briefing emphasizes that nations and corporations are frantically rebuilding their supply chains around resilience. They are shifting from just-in-time to just-in-case.
And think about the financial mechanism of just-in-case.
It sounds expensive.
It's massively expensive. It means building huge new warehouses, buying excess inventory, and tying up billions of dollars in capital just to have a buffer.
Wow.
It requires a massive push for domestic manufacturing and strategic independence.
So they can't rely on global shipping anymore.
Right. Things that used to be purely commercial decisions, like where a country sources its agricultural fertilizer, its generic pharmaceuticals, or its critical minerals, they are now viewed strictly through the lens of national security. Everything is being repatriated.
So we basically spent decades trading resilience for efficiency, and now we are paying an astronomical premium to try and buy that resilience back.
That's a perfect summary.
And speaking of astronomical premiums, this brings us to what I think is the most ironic pattern in the entire briefing.
Oh, the tech infrastructure.
Yes. Yeah. Because just as global supply chains are being forced to prioritize heavy industry, physical resilience over theoretical efficiency, the most advanced ethereal digital technology in the world is running into its own massive physical limits.
You are talking about the artificial intelligence infrastructure bubble.
Exactly. The briefing highlights that the AI boom is facing its first major stress test, and it has absolutely nothing to do with software. We've seen these record-breaking investments in hyperscale data centers, but now all that boundless digital ambition is clashing violently with basic economic and physical reality.
Because the constraints aren't in the code, right? The constraints are in the concrete.
Yes.
To understand this, we really need to define what a hyperscale data center actually is.
Right, because it's not just a closet with some blinking lights.
No, we aren't talking about a server room in the basement of an office building. We are talking about facilities the size of multiple football fields.
Which is huge.
And they're housing tens of thousands of specialized servers operating 24 hours a day.
I think we have been conditioned, you know, to view the cloud as this invisible, magical, weightless thing.
Oh, absolutely.
But the cloud is just someone else's very hot, very thirsty computer building.
That is exactly what it is.
And local city councils across the country are suddenly waking up to this reality. They're delaying or outright rejecting these massive AI data centers.
Because they can't support them.
Yeah, right. The most cutting-edge tech companies in the world are being bottlenecked by municipal zoning meetings.
Well, the pushback from these local councils comes down to unprecedented resource consumption.
How much resource are we talking about?
An AI data center draws gigawatts of power. Some of these planned facilities require the equivalent energy output of a small nuclear reactor just to function.
Just for one facility?
Just for one. And because these specialized chips run incredibly hot, the cooling systems require millions of gallons of fresh water.
Wait, why fresh water? Can't they just use, like, recycled water or closed-loop systems?
They can, but the most energy-efficient way to cool these massive buildings is often evaporative cooling.
Okay, how does that work?
It relies on drawing in massive amounts of local water, evaporating it to absorb heat, and constantly replenishing the supply.
Oh, so it just consumes the water.
Yes, and this raises an agonizing civic question. Who gets priority? Does a city allocate its limited water reservoir to a tech company's cooling towers or to its local agriculture?
Wow. It's as if AI is this massive hyper-intelligent brain we've built, but it just woke up and realized it needs a massive digestive system to survive.
I love that analogy.
Like it needs power grids and water reservoirs, and the physical body just can't keep up with the brain's appetite.
It really can't.
If you think about your own summer energy bills or the rolling blackouts we've seen in places like Texas or California during a heat wave, now imagine dropping a facility requiring the power of a nuclear reactor into that exact same fragile grid.
The pattern the briefing identifies here is a harsh return to financial and physical discipline.
Right. The bubble is meeting reality.
Throw in rising construction costs, supply chain delays for specialized transformers, and higher interest rates.
Hmm.
and you have tech giants being forced to scale down their physical footprint.
So they literally can't build as fast as they want to.
Exactly. The AI race is not going to be won simply by whoever writes the smartest algorithm.
Right.
It is going to be won by whoever can actually secure the physical land, the energy resources, and the public support to sustain it.
Which means the future of technology is entirely dependent on the physical environment providing those exact resources.
Yes. It is deeply tethered to the physical world.
And right now, as the final major pattern in the briefing lays out, that environment is experiencing historic volatility.
You really cannot talk about global supply chains, maritime shipping, or energy-hungry AI infrastructure without talking about the physical climate they exist within.
They're completely linked.
Completely. The briefing points out how global climate extremes, record heat waves, widespread flooding, severe storms, rapidly expanding wildfires, they are actively testing the resilience of every modern system we've discussed today.
And the key takeaway that really struck me from the source material is this concept. Environmental events have become economic events.
Right.
Because we are so used to seeing extreme weather on the evening news as just a localized tragedy, you know, a damaged town, a flooded street.
Yeah, a human interest story.
Exactly. But the systemic pattern is so much deeper.
Let's trace the mechanism of how a local weather event becomes a global economic stressor.
Okay, let's follow the thread.
A prolonged drought in a major agricultural region doesn't just dry up lawns. It drastically reduces crop yields.
Right.
That country suddenly has to import millions of tons of food, which spikes global commodity prices.
Which impacts everyone.
And the farmers need to import more specialized fertilizer to revive the soil, where it puts immediate stress on the exact same maritime shipping lanes we talked about earlier.
Wow, it all loops back.
It does. Meanwhile, a record heat wave in a tech hub stresses the electrical grid right when those AI data centers need maximum power for cooling.
Which leads to brownouts.
Leading to brownouts that halt industrial production.
And all of this forces massive recalibrations in the financial sector. Specifically with insurance. We talked about maritime insurance earlier, but the briefing delves into domestic risk models as well.
The insurance aspect is arguably the most critical thread here.
Really? More than the infrastructure?
Yeah, because insurance and reinsurance companies are fundamentally reassessing their entire risk models. If a coastal region or a wildfire-prone area becomes mathematically uninsurable, it triggers a cascading systemic loop.
Walk me through that loop. How does a lack of insurance actually break a municipality?
Okay, well, if a homeowner can't get fire or flood insurance, the bank will not issue them a mortgage.
Right, the bank won't take the risk.
If mortgages disappear, the local real estate market instantly collapses. Property values plummet.
Okay, I see where this is going.
Right, and because municipal governments rely primarily on property taxes for their revenue, the city's tax base just evaporates.
No, wow.
Suddenly, the city cannot afford to pay for the basic infrastructure upgrades like better drainage systems or reinforced power grids that are needed to protect against the next storm.
So the city is left completely exposed.
Exactly.
Are the institutions just trapped in this death spiral? Like, what is the response?
The systemic shift occurring globally right now is that municipalities, heavy industry, and national governments, they are moving away from the old model of disaster recovery.
Okay.
And they're moving toward long-term resilience planning. The assumption that tomorrow's weather will look like yesterday's weather has been completely abandoned by the engineers and urban planners actually designing our world.
There's that word again, resilience.
It is the defining theme of the Great Global Convergence.
Yeah.
We are moving past the idea of just rebuilding what broke and hoping it survives the next season. Planners are designing for extremes.
What does that look like in practice?
It means building elevated substations to avoid floods, transitioning to decentralized microgrids so a single point of failure doesn't black out an entire city,
right,
and entirely rethinking where human infrastructure can safely exist.
Okay, so let's take a breath and pull all of this together.
That's a lot.
It is a lot. What does this all mean for you, the listener? We've covered a massive amount of ground today, but when you look at it through the lens of this briefing, the structural threads are undeniable.
They really are.
We've explored how energy bottlenecks in the Middle East dictate maritime insurance, which affects inflation in your hometown.
Right.
We've seen how the future of advanced technology and AI is entirely tethered to physical infrastructure, power grids, and, of all things, local zoning laws.
Yeah, water rights and city councils.
We've seen how volatile weather directly dictates global food production and municipal tax bases, and we've seen how the battle for information and institutional trust is fundamentally reshaping national security.
Everything is connected.
Every single system touches another system.
And I want to offer a conscious wrap-up here, what the briefing calls a truth seeker's reflection.
Please do.
When you look at all these massive converging forces simultaneously, it can feel incredibly overwhelming.
Very much so.
It can induce a deep sense of panic or helplessness. But understanding these structural patterns is actually profoundly empowering.
Because it takes the chaos and gives it a shape.
Exactly. It allows you to step out of the reactive, fear-based media cycle.
Yes.
When you see a terrifying headline tomorrow about a supply chain crisis or a new cyber threat, you don't have to just react emotionally to the alarm bells.
Right. You don't have to just panic.
You can look at it as a grounded, balanced observer. You can ask yourself, which of these larger structural threads is pulling on this specific event?
You start to see the matrix, basically.
You begin to see the architecture behind the news, rather than just drowning in the debris of the day.
I love that. The source material actually has a brilliant line that anchors this exact sentiment. It explicitly states, "The goal is not to know everything. The goal is to see clearly."
That's a great quote.
I think that is incredibly profound. You don't need to be an expert in naval logistics, semiconductor cooling systems, or municipal tax law to navigate the world.
Right. Nobody can be an expert in all of that.
Clarity comes from observation, from spotting the patterns, and from centering your own inner world so you aren't swept away by the daily outrage cycle.
Well said. And, you know, I want to leave our listeners with one final thought to mull over, building directly on this theme of total interconnectedness.
Okay, let's hear it.
We've established today that all these massive global systems, cybersecurity, AI infrastructure, global agriculture, and energy shipping, they're being forcibly interwoven and rebuilt for resilience simultaneously right now.
Right. We are witnessing the painful transition from just in time to just in case.
The great rewiring of the world.
Yeah.
So here is the provocative question to consider. If all these systems are becoming so deeply and heavily linked, does a severe disruption in one area risk a total unstoppable cascade across everything?
Ooh.
Or does this forced, agonizing global stress test we are living through right now actually mean that the world of 2030 will emerge virtually immune to the kind of single-point domino effect failures we all experienced during the pandemic?
Are we building a fragile house of cards, or are we forging a titanium net?
Exactly.
That is a fascinating way to look at the future. Thank you for diving into the deep end with us today. Keep observing, keep questioning, and we'll see you next time.